Hello everybody, this is Chandradasa from the Buddhist Centre Online at thebuddhistcentre.com with another edition of Buddhist Voices. And I'm very happy to be joined here by my friend Amalavatra, who is, well, you'll find out, he's had a very interesting arc in his life, which we're going to talk about today. And this series generally goes into the stories of how people found the Dharma and how it's currently a feature in their lives. And Amalavatra's got some very good things to say about this, which I've personally found inspiring when I've heard about them. So welcome, Amalavatra.
Thank you very much, Chandradasa.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Very good.
Yeah.
Enjoying being here at Adistana. But it's not too hot. That's where it goes.
It's true, it's where it goes. We could be down a mine.
Exactly.
In
that's
Rwanda.
Right. That's right. But we're having meetings and tea breaks.
We're having meetings and tea breaks. And you have ended up here. Well, actually, it's not that unusual. You might think that an English country house in some beautiful property in a very unspoiled bit of England, a very beautiful bit of England, wouldn't be outside of your realm of experience, would it?
No. Is that a lead-in? Am I...
we're trailing, folks. This is us trailing the content. And you'll see why in a little minute. But we'll go back to the start. So give us a brief potted history of Amalavatra up to the point where you met the Dharma. Let's hear about your life you met the Dharma.
Well, I grew up in Berkshire, just in the Thames Valley, west of London, southeast of England. And my father was a businessman, a sort of company director, and my mother worked for John Lewis, which is a great ethical company, actually, supermarkets and department stores in the UK. So what to say about that? You know, so in a way I would have said pretty standard kind of, I suppose you'd say middle class, you know, upper middle class childhood, sort of mixture of some private schools, some normal schools, grammar school. I went to lots of schools.
Why did you go to lots of schools?
I don't know, really. I think it would maybe ambition in a certain way, like academically. So generally kind of going on to new schools when the old school wasn't sort of quite academic enough.
Are these posh schools or are these kind of just standard schools?
They were all, I mean, they're either grammar schools or private schools on the whole.
Okay.
And at 16, I went to a boarding school in Oxford called St. Edward's School.
Was your dad a successful businessman?
Yeah, I'd say reasonably so. He didn't have that... Oh, sorry, Dad, if you're listening. he wasn't... I mean, I don't think, to his credit, I don't think he had the ruthlessness to be a really successful businessman.
What was his business?
Actually, he was more like a company director, so he trained as he was a finance director and then marketing director. So it was a different business. He was finance director for Lovell Homes, you know them, the building company. An oil exploration company, a company trading with Central Europe and back in the days before the wall came down. So yeah, sort of small to medium sized companies. And then eventually he became a consultant to businesses, you know, set up his own company, just helping small companies. So he really loved commerce, he loved business, and really wanted to help businesses do well. Yeah, but he didn't have that kind of really ruthless, ambitious edge to really, you know, be super...
Well, good.
Exactly, yes.
So we say good.
Yes.
So you get to St. Edward's boarding school.
Yeah.
Particular English experience, isn't it, come to boarding school?
Oh, it was a horrible experience. Well, because I went when I was 16, so by then, in a way, the little cliques are pretty formed by that point. Plus, there's a particular culture that everyone's had the training in, which I hadn't had, so I found it very difficult. In fact, I really hated it, about most two difficult most years of my life. And the two people I did make good friends with, who I'm still in touch with, were both, like me, had joined at the same time. So in a sense, what we shared was this kind of sense of complete kind of, I suppose you could say alienation, but, you know, just kind of like, what is going on here?
And was it like the classic picture of English boarding school that you get in things like If and kind of various novels, etc.? I mean, is it that sort of really, really strange, quite internalised world, or is it all a bit more normal, but...
I mean, we didn't have those extreme things that you might read about, like fagging and beatings and sorts of weird sexual practices. You know, I don't remember anything like that. It wasn't like that.
You should see my face.
But it's quite a hard environment. Like, what I wrote, there's a lot of teasing. And in retrospect, I can see that actually that's the way that you make friendships. But it's pretty hard school, you know, of Knox. It's like real kind of quite hard. I mean, I think I took that too seriously, took it too personally at the time. I think that's one of the things I would have known if I'd been through the whole prep school system, is like that's how you kind of become friends, is someone kind of mocks you and you kind of mock him back, and then you're actually, that's you becoming friends.
Although I suppose you could argue that you probably sense that you're quite a naturally sensitive soul, as it were. Probably stood you in some stead since then,
but at the time it was horrible, yeah. And I really had to harden up. I mean, this is one of the reasons people send their kids to boarding schools, it's kind of character building, so I did toughen up in a certain way, but I think part of that toughening up is also closing down a bit, yeah. And what part of my toughening up was actually thinking, oh right, so I've got to be aggressive to do well here. So I actually remember getting into a fight with someone and breaking my hand punching him, and he was a really nice guy. He was like, people were like, why did you hit Will, you know, he's like, you know, so that was a weird kind of way it went. The other thing I was really into was rowing, so that was another way to kind of get some, I suppose, status or security. Unfortunately, rowing, you know, it would have been better if I'd been good at rugby, because that was the real scorecard, card was being the first 15. Yeah, that was one.
So you were rowing for St Edward's, and yes. where did you go after that finished?
I had a year off, which was really formative. I mean, as it is for many people, I went to Central America and then North America, actually about 7 months in total, just going around on my own. It was, which at 18 was
brave.
I mean, extraordinary in retrospect that I did that. Yeah, but that's
where'd you go? I was in
Belize for a couple of months on this coral key conservation project. It's not the toughest, again, it's not that, but mine in Rwanda or anything. I mean, this was like going scuba diving in the Caribbean twice a day, charting the coral reef. So, you know, we were doing work, but it wasn't.
I'm trying to think of a universe where that is work. You know, we were going scuba diving in the Caribbean twice a day.
That's right, yeah.
I hope they weren't paying you for it, at least.
No, no. They
good.
I think, in fact, we had to pay our own way, but yes.
And then back to North America?
Well, then around Central America. So I went around on the buses and stuff all around Nicaragua and Guatemala and down to Costa Rica and then up into North America doing the Greyhound buses.
Oh, cool. Right,
yeah, yes. Yeah. I've got some family up there because my grandmother was American from California, so did some travel.
And that's a particular world, isn't it, the Greyhound bus?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. So you get back from that, and then what happens?
Well, then I went to Cambridge. Actually, I missed out a bit because before I went to save the money for travelling, I worked in the London Stock Exchange for a few months. In the daytime, in the evening, I was delivering pizzas for Pizza Hut. So I had quite an intensive few months there.
You've got this. I like this theme. I'm going to come back to this theme in this story because this theme of two sides of life.
Right.
There's the kind of scuba diving and the you know, doing lovely stuff in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And then going around America on a Greyhound bus, which is a very, usually for people, that involves witnessing sometimes levels of poverty, kind of cultural poverty.
That's true.
That you wouldn't see many places. And then you've got this, you know, stock exchange by day, pizza.
That's right.
By night.
That's right, yeah. On a moped wearing a plastic red suit.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Can we have photographs of this? Anyway, so let's bear in mind that kind of dual thing.
Yeah, that's
I think
true.
That becomes a theme, doesn't it?
Right, yeah. Yeah, so that's how I saved up the money for the trip. And came back and went to Cambridge, to study economics, a college called Peterhouse.
Yes.
And that's where I went for the next 3 years.
So for a lot of people listening, this sounds like quite a privileged life in a way, and quite a sort of safe environment for you. You know, you're kind of, at that point, you're well embedded in normal society and even the kind of upper echelons of normal society.
Yeah, I mean, not super upper echelons, but enough to live that kind of life. And when I was a child, we used to go on foreign holidays, skiing holidays, and I remember going to Australia or America, which then was a bit less common to make those trips. So, yeah, I was definitely lucky and had a very stable family. My parents got on well, my brother generally went on what we got on well, and I think I had a really good ethical grounding, actually, from my parents. I think, although they're neither of them particularly interested in spiritual life, they're both, I think, very ethical people, and I did get a really good grounding in ethics, which, as we know, is the basis for spiritual life. So I was very fortunate in that regard. I was in a very kind of, you know, the environment was psychologically healthy and sort of ethically positive. So that's very, I feel very grateful for that.
So you're at Peterhouse. Did the boarding school experience help with coping with university in Cambridge and the pressure of that? Yeah,
that's right. I mean, it probably even helped me with the year off that if I could handle 2 years at St Edward's, I could handle the Greyhound buses, if you like.
Just being abroad alone.
That's right, that's right. Well, you know, I mean, basically learned to deal with loneliness. I was really, you know, lonely at that school, so then you can be on your own, it's all right. Mm. Cambridge, I mean, so again, of course, that was going away, living away from home, so that was fine, I was used to that. Mm. I later found out in that first year that I was seen as rather arrogant.
You were seen as arrogant?
Yes, when I turned up at... I was saying something at Cambridge.
to appear arrogant at Cambridge, you must have been.
Fantastic.
Maybe you could do an impersonation of how arrogant you were for us, just so we as well.
I think actually I was a bit shy, actually, and a bit kind of slightly cut off in a way. And that's right, and therefore came across arrogant. Yeah, actually, of course, like all of us, I wanted friends and so forth.
And did you row at Cambridge?
I did, yeah. I plunged right into rowing, and particularly into lightweight rowing, because I'm not that tall. Since this is a radio channel, I will...
He's not that small, either. He's sort of in between.
But in rowing, you've got to be really got to be 6'3" or so to really do well. And I'm 5'9", not 5'10". So
you ain't a cox.
I did cox when I was a child, but I was a lightweight oarsman. So I rowed for the university lightweight crew. That was my thing. And they were pleased to have me because I'd had a lot of experience of schoolboy rowing. And whereas a lot of people who turn up at Cambridge never rowed. So yeah, I got right into the Cambridge lightweight crew my first year and did that all 3 years actually. And that's a lot. That's a big commitment. I used to train twice a day every day.
And does that qualify you to be a Cambridge blue?
Half blue. You've got to be heavyweight.
You've got to get the full blue.
Yeah.
This is probably incomprehensible to people out there. Outside of Britain, it's probably like we're speaking some coded language.
That's right.
This is the language of class in Britain, folks, just in case you don't understand. So bear with us. And it's actually a bit relevant to what happens next, just so stay tuned.
And it does say what kind of tie and what kind of blazer you can wear at Henley Regatta, you know, so it does matter, you know.
And Henley Regatta is the foremost water-based event for a certain class of people in Britain.
And it's big social occasions like Ascot and all those sort of isn't it?
Part of the establishment.
Yeah, Henley definitely Regatta. Part of the establishment, yeah.
So you come out of Cambridge, and what is the world that you move into?
Well, I actually hesitate before moving on, because I'd been trying so hard at Cambridge with all the rowing. Also, in the summer, I used to sell bookstore to door in America. One summer, I was in Tennessee.
Wow! See, again, it's very strange. I'm really fascinated with this juxtaposition of worlds. Like,
yeah.
I mean, most people would not go from Peterhouse College in Cambridge, rowing... Yeah. In a way, a very kind of refined world to selling books door to door in America in Tennessee. How did you end up there?
Well, I suppose one of the things about my parents, although my background was relatively privileged, they never spoiled me. So I'd always had to earn my own money. Mm. They didn't give me that much in terms of pocket money. I used to deliver newspapers and watch cars.
But you could have gone and worked in a shop.
That's true.
Instead, Tennessee.
Well, it's funny, the way they marketed the book selling, they obviously didn't put up posters saying, come and sell books door to door. They said something, I can't remember what they said, there's a company called Southwest, and a poster saying, you know, challenge yourself, change your mind, grow, develop this summer, do something tough that's also going to probably make you rich as well. I can't remember what they said. But, you know, it was something that was a challenge, and it certainly is, you can imagine. And I responded to it, and I thought, yeah, okay, I'll do that. Of course, going to the States, I was happy about it. I love the States. So, yeah.
So you're travelling around, staying in motels?
No, we used to stay with a family. So the way it was all set up, in the sense that they would train us how to find a place to stay. So we had a week sales school in Memphis, Tennessee. And then we'd go to our place. I think that first summer I was in Jackson, Tennessee. As in the famous song, go to Jackson. And we went to a church, you know, local church, I think it was evangelical church, and said, look, we're students, we need somewhere to stay for the summer, we're going to do a summer job, can you put us up? And this really top, I think it was a gynecologist, put us up in his very, very big posh house, a friend and I, and we stayed there in his, in fact, we shared a double bed for 10 weeks, and we're hardly ever in it because we were mostly out working. We used to work from 8 in the morning till about 9:30, 10 at night, 6 days a week.
What kind of books are you selling?
Well, originally it was a Bible company, but we were selling study guides, basically, helping kids with their studies. Yeah, and there's a lot of other add-ons you could get as well.
And how many summers did you do that for?
2 summers.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so you
did that, made a lot of money, it was a good money maker. Learned a lot about determination, discipline. I mean, that was hard.
I bet it was
hot. Nobody wants door-to-door sellers. And you're kind of going around.
And you've got a weird accent as well.
Yeah, which actually slightly helps and slightly doesn't help, because they slightly don't trust you. You know, you probably know this from living in the States, like, they're interested, but also, who are you?
That's right. Yeah. You know, why are you at my door?
So that's right, yeah. So, but yeah.
And what was your degree at Cambridge?
Economics. I've never had a passion for study, really. Can't remember, why I did economics? How do I know? Well, I'd always wanted to be rich, so that was probably part of it. That was my childhood goal, was to be a millionaire.
Wow.
So doing economics made a lot of sense in that regard. As we shall later see.
As we shall later see, yes, and being rich is also a theme, isn't it? Or richness.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So you come out of Cambridge?
Came out of Cambridge, but, oh yeah, point story, after all that rowing, all that book selling, I needed a break, especially because I'd had a big crisis in as much as I'd been president of the boat club, and we lost the boat race. Disaster. You know, okay, there might be mines collapsing, but losing a boat race, that felt like really bad news that time.
Did they sort of ostracise you or something?
No, they were very good about it. In fact, they let me come back the next year and we won it, so it was all right.
Good.
But still, actually, funny, in a funny kind of way, that did set me really rethinking, hold on, what? Because I'd given up so much to do that rowing, like social life, love life, education, the whole thing. I just put everything into that. To lose it was really trying not to say devastating, but anyway,
it felt devastating.
It felt devastating. Yeah, it certainly did. Yeah,
defeat.
So, yeah. In a sense, I think it personally is a defeat of me because I really put myself into it. Yeah. So after that, I was suddenly, in a way, searching in a funny kind of way, not consciously for religion, but I then wanted a year off. Everyone else was doing the milk round and getting jobs in management consultancy and finance and everything, and I wanted a year off. I did take a summer job in JP Morgan, an investment bank, but I knew I didn't want to go straight into work. I wanted time off. But they did actually offer me a full-time job when I got back from my travel, so I went to Nepal.
Wow.
And trekked all around the Himalayas, what's called the Annapurna Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
Got into an amazingly positive state of mind. You know, it's just so beautiful up there, just walking all day, eating very simple food, going to bed early. And came back into Kathmandu, amazing state, and the best I'd ever felt. It was extraordinary. And then
went to work for JP Morgan.
Well, not straight away. No, I saw a poster for a talk about Buddhism, the symbolism of the Vajra.
Mm.
I just know why I wanted to go to that, but I went, and it was a London order member called Amogi Chitta giving the talk.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I can't remember the details. I obviously found it really interesting because he then said, "Well, we're running a meditation day or 2 days. You can learn to meditate." I thought, "Oh yeah." Had very strong experience of meditation, especially after all that trek, and just.
Sort
of dhyana experience, really, a blissful experience, and thought, wow, this is something. Not just the experience of meditation, but actually outside of meditation, I felt alive to my surroundings, to the squares, the little squares in Kathmandu, the temples, just the plants, everything, in a way that I'd never felt before. I felt like it was completely new, and that I'd only been able to access before through maybe recreational drugs or something, you know, altered state like that. So, yeah, so I knew that when I got back to the UK, I was going to look this up.
So that gets seeded in Nepal.
Yeah.
And then you're back to London.
Back to London. Go to JP Morgan.
Which, I mean, and we should probably pause at this point just to say JP Morgan, so an investment bank And, you know, investment banks these days don't have such a good rep, as it were. In fact, it's probably the modern bête noire, isn't it?
It is, it's true.
So you're entering that world. What was it like?
I was so deeply bored when I first went there. It was awful, you know, partly because I couldn't do much because I wasn't qualified, so just had to listen to these phone calls between traders and salesmen and their clients. But then, actually, once I started to get my own clients, and the good thing about investment banks is they do give you responsibility pretty quick. I mean, it does mean you've got 25-year-olds able to lose 3 billion quid or whatever, but, you know...
Can we come back and define a good thing?
Well, it's a good thing, personally, it's a bit more interesting.
Yeah,
sure. So I started getting my own clients, then making money for the bank, and then you get a lot of praise, and they start giving you bonuses, and you get a credit card so you can, you know, go to great restaurants. And I remember going to a conference in Bermuda, flying business class to Bermuda for a conference. That was quite nice, and things like that.
So you're basically, I mean, you're immersed in a world of money at that point.
Yes, right? That's right.
The whole environment is...
Oh, yeah, and everyone's making a lot of money, spending a lot of money. Yeah.
You were into having been bored initially?
Yeah, for a little while, yeah. I'd always been into being successful and doing well. And those, you know, they were into me doing well, and they were encouraging. And they, you know, so I got clients quickly, they gave me responsibility quickly. Well, in fact, quite quickly I became the product manager for something called asset-backed securities, which was a really new product back then. It was basically bonds backed by people's credit card debts. And I was... You know, one of the first people introducing them into the London market, into the European market, actually. And I didn't remember doing a tour of Europe, explaining these to people. Anyway, that later became the infamous mortgage-backed securities, which brought almost brought down many European banks, who were my clients. I mean, I was dealing with banks like that. We were at the whole point of selling those bonds to those kind of banks who wanted AAA-rated, meaning good credit rating securities, but a good return too, and that's what these magic bonds offered.
And internally, because I mean, often the critique of that period is, how come nobody stopped and thought, wait a minute, this is actually all too good to be true, therefore, if you've got credit card debt as the security for a bond, surely at some point, I mean, you don't have to be an investment banker to think, well, maybe, did nobody stop and think?
Well, of course, you had credit card debt, and you had credit card debt, so you had some issuers who had better quality debtors than others, so people knew that much. But actually, the market rolled on for years and years, none of these bonds were defaulting. They were AAA rated by the accepted rating agencies like Moody's and Standard & Poor's. You know, so it would be a bit like you could make a fuss and say, hold on, this can't be true. But everyone would say, but it is true. Look, it's working. And it's been working for years. Sure. In fact, I was one of the people saying that because I'd go to Paris or something and explain. And then they'd say, what? A AAA rated security, meaning the same quality as the US government, and yet it gives me this return, whereas the US government gives me almost nothing. How can that be possible? And you say, well, it is.
It is, until it's not. Because isn't the issue in a way that people, you know, as it worked and worked and worked and people saw it as being advantageous to take these bonds, it's like people take more and more risks with the level of debt that you're going to back something up with, or subprime mortgages.
That's right, that's right.
You start going for the mortgages that aren't particularly
safe. That's right. They started to really lower the bar. It sounds as though, I mean, I was out of the market by this point, but it sounds like the credit agencies started to sort of be led in that way as well, probably the investment banks who in a way have the sway really because they have the money,
right?
And they pay the credit rating agencies,
and that's the other side of a closed world, isn't it?
Yeah.
Money where everything,
yeah,
in that bubble it all makes sense or something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And in a sense, even if you know it doesn't make sense, it doesn't mean you leave the market. You just need to know to leave the market before everyone else works out that it's not making sense, and that's what some quite clever traders did.
That's right.
Yeah.
They bet on it.
They bet against it. Yeah, they bet on it failing at a certain point, and some of them made a lot of money doing that, yeah.
So, I mean, what were your kind of first inklings of real dissatisfaction with that world?
Well, it was... In a way, it was that they're all along, but it particularly grew after being there a year or two, because it kind of starts to get a bit boring just being on the phone all day long from 7 in the morning till 6 at night, phoning people, trying to get them to buy stuff. I mean, okay, these are big, expensive bonds, not double glazing, but it's still pretty boring.
And it's still pizza delivery, isn't it? You're still...
Basically, I guess you're selling the pizza as well as...
Even more passive. You don't have a motorbike.
You don't
have
a motorbike. That's right. It just feels a bit meaningless as well, you know, because you think, well, what actually am I contributing here to? Well, what am I creating here? I started to have fantasies of, you know, working in a factory, you know, for an industrial company. At least then you'd be churning out motorbikes or computers or something that actually has a physical reality, whereas all I was just doing is... You know, it's just numbers on the screen. Of course, then I did get numbers in my bank account too, but even that felt a bit unreal, except I realised it was real. But yeah, slightly unreal world, really. And when I looked around at the people around me, I didn't see people who were particularly happy or satisfied. And I also saw how ruthless it was. I mean, people, you know, there'd be regular layoffs. You know, like I remember once there was a big crisis in Brazil, emerging market securities collapsed, which meant the bank lost a load of money, which meant they had to fire 10% of all the staff. And I thought, oh God, is it going to be me? So I panicked a bit. It wasn't me. They weren't interested in laying off people like me. It was people earning more money and so forth. But, it was that kind of environment. I mean, actually good people as well. It wasn't sort of some ruthless, fierce group of people. Actually some good people.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, only a very particular narrow perspective on life, which was making money for the bank and making money for yourself. To be honest, there's no other motivation for doing that I can see. I mean, I guess the excitement of making a deal, but there was no purpose or meaning beyond enriching the bank and therefore yourself. This is a pretty narrow perspective on life.
Yeah. It's quite interesting, the evocation of the people who work there. It's all quite normal.
Yeah.
I think when people outside that world think of it, it's titans and power and Leonardo DiCaprio standing on a desk in Wolf of Wall Street yelling at people. Like, it's not that, is it?
No, it's not that. I mean, I enjoyed watching that film, but that was so overblown from anything I experienced. I mean, there were one or two big characters, and both of them could be extremely harsh. I remember one of them just giving a complete dressing down to this one credit analyst in front of the whole trade. The training floor is like 300 or 400 people, and the whole thing just stopped while he just ripped this guy to shreds. you know, this poor little mole-like guy who made a mistake. And whereas this guy had been in the army, he'd been an officer in the army, and he gave him a proper old-fashioned dressing down. So that was, you know, stuff like that was pretty unpleasant. Mm. But that happened very rarely. I mean, probably a handful of those instances in my 3 years, if that. I mean,
so you're a bit dissatisfied and it's a bit dull. And
yeah, really. That's the weird thing, is being a bit bored by it after a while. And this was in the context of meditating. I was going to the London Buddhist Centre, which was just down the road, actually, and I was going on retreats. And they were always particularly powerful, because then, again, like that Kathmandu experience, I'd have a very different experience of my mind and therefore of life. And then, and then I'd go back to work and see it kind of unravel very quickly. And I thought, hold on, I'd rather stay in the other zone, thank you very much. So that contrast became marked. And I think in some mysterious way, you know, as you're meditating, as you're engaging the Sangha, as I was, I'll say a bit about that in a minute, well, then your heart starts to open, you start to, values become important. I remember that point, before that point, I didn't even know what a value was. People would talk about values, and I was like, what is that? I don't know what that means. You know, it was just, I didn't literally know what that meant. So I was, I suppose, at an intuitive level, starting to get a sense of values, and therefore just being on the phone all day, trying to flog bonds, trying to invent new trade ideas, which is, oh God, you know, just, it just felt increasingly meaningless, and therefore unsatisfactory.
How long did it take you to get out?
Well, just over 3 years. I mean, from when I started. So I was in the business just over 3 years. I mean, actually, I quit pretty abruptly. You know, in a way, there's that positive recklessness of youth, I guess. I mean, I remember I went on a retreat in the Easter and had an amazing experience and thought, right, that's it. And then, so I went and did a trial at Windhorse, thinking I'd go and work Windhorse Trading. Did a week there, and that was amazing too. I'm really grateful to Windhorse for that, because it... you know, I lived the Windhorse life, if you like, for a week.
So Windhorse Trading is a Buddhist business in Cambridge, big collective place where lots of people come and work, and the whole basis is give what you can, take what you need. They don't do hierarchies according to salary, etc. It's not doing any of that.
Well, no, they've got a lifestyle where practice is prioritised, so you don't start work till 9 or 9.30, so you've got time to meditate, you know, walk along the river to work, very nice, you know, it works... quite human in a way, and you finish at 5 and you've got time to actually have a life outside of work. So I, that was a real revelation. And so within a few weeks, I quit. And so within 2 months of that retreat, I'd left the city.
Had you been building up to that, do you think, through, I mean, consciously building up to thinking, will I leave, will I not leave? Or was it just, did it just come like that?
I had been building up to, I mean, in fact, a few months before that, my solution had been, all right, I'll go to business school in America. I thought, I know I've had enough of this. I don't know what I want to do, so I'll go to business school, which I think is why a lot of people do MBAs. They don't know what they want to do, but they don't want to destroy their CV.
Harvard Business School, the whole thing.
Yeah, I applied to Harvard Business School, Stanford. I was already starting to get into that, but I didn't yet have enough kind of clarity or faith to think, I'll give it up and go and be a Buddhist. I thought, I'll give it up and do something that'll give me time to think about things.
And so what are your family thinking about all this? They're watching you in a week. Do very well, going to university, become a very rounded individual from a certain point of view, by travelling and doing all sorts of interesting things. You get a fantastic job in the city in London, you're earning lots of money. What did they think when you started to kind of become a Buddhist and sort of pull out of a particular arc that you were on?
Well, I think they were fine. Most, you know, except doing an MBA, of course. My dad did an MBA, that all made perfect sense to them. My mum actually wasn't very impressed with the work I was doing. She thought it was a bit pointless, so she was fine about me leaving that.
Good old mum. Well done. Well done, mum. Mrs. Webb.
I think when they, you know, when I was talking about going and working for a giftware business in Cambridge, they were like, not sure about that. And then, especially because at that time, actually, Windhorse didn't particularly have its ethical thing sorted out. So my mum, who was working in retail, said, I don't understand why, you know, what's so special about this company? They don't even have fair trade or something, you know, what's the thing? But now they do, of course. But what happened was I went and did a Caroline appeal.
Okay, so first of all, what year is all this?
Just May 99, so 15 years ago.
15, so you're going to become a millennial Buddhist. This is it.
A millennial Buddhist, you're right, it'll happen,
You're coming in there.
Yeah.
And so you go to work for Karuna. Now, do you want to say a little bit about who Karuna is for people who don't?
So Karuna is Tri Ratna's charity that works in India with the so-called untouchable or Dalit people. Many of them are Buddhist, so there's a natural kind of link between us and them. And they're generally incredibly poor and excluded from mainstream society. So Karuna runs education projects, health projects, cultural projects, livelihood projects to help those people lift themselves out of poverty, enter society, and also Buddhist projects to actually have a positive path of growth and identity. And Karanar Appeals are 6-week door-to-door...
Door-to-door?
Yeah, well, exactly, get it. That's right, the door-to-door thing. 6-week door-to-door residential thing. You get together, there's a team of you, 4 or 5 men, 4 or 5 women, go to another city somewhere in the UK, and you go out fundraising every night. So, yeah, I knew that I could do door-to-door, because I'd done those summers. Yeah. So when Jairaja came, who used to work for Karanar, came to the London Buddhist Centre and said, we're looking for volunteers, I knew I was about to quit JP Morgan, so I'd have some time. So I said, yeah, I'll do that.
Great.
Yeah.
That was the first thing you did after you quit JP Morgan, was go and knock doors for India.
It was a week. In fact, I left JP Morgan, went straight on my first ever solitary retreat for 8 days or 9 days, and then went straight to Karanar Appeal, which was all a bit mad. I had a slight meltdown, I'll tell you, that first day. That first day on the appeal.
You do move between worlds, don't you? You like that thing.
That was an interesting observation.
No, we talked about this. I remember the other day we were talking about going to the Henley Regatta.
Oh, yeah.
I'd seen a picture of you and your dad on Facebook and your blazers
Boaters. That's right.
And you were saying, well, actually, I wore that walking through the East End of London.
That's right.
To the London Buddhist Centre through, you know, very ethnic Bangladeshi area. And it's like, and you were saying, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that taking one thing from one world.
That's true, yeah, I like that all being part of one life, that it can be integrated. I think it can. I mean, you can be a Buddhist and still go to Henley Regatta.
And did your skills transfer well to Karanar? Did you do
I did very well. That first appeal, I did really, really well. I had a lot of drive. I worked really hard. I used all my determination, my skills, my charm, everything I had, and I raised a lot of money. In fact, I don't know if I broke a record. I think I did. It was certainly kind of one of the highest first appeals. Yeah.
Brilliant.
It was great. Yeah. And actually, within a couple of weeks, I loved it so much, I asked Jairaja if I could just come and work for Karanar. So I'd already actually been accepted to go and work at Windhorse Trading, but I had a change of heart. I just loved this so much.
Hmm.
Particularly, I mean, the meaning aspect of raising money for something meaningful, but also the fact that I just felt so alive doing it, because I had to connect with other people in order for them to want to give money to me. To connect with other people, I had to connect with myself. I just felt... You know, other people were more real, I was more real, and all this magic money was appearing for people in India, so I loved it, And that actually was the start of, 14 years with Karanar. In fact, I'm still doing a bit of it, but I worked for them full-time for a long time.
So you did all your Buddhist training in that context?
I'm very, very grateful for that. I mean, I lived in the Karanar community for 7 years, I worked in the Karanar office for, I don't know, 12 years or something. That was full on. You know, I was sharing rooms a lot of the time. At one point, I was sharing rooms with Jairaja, who was also my manager. So you can imagine, it's pretty intense. But we had a fantastic team. I think of that as a kind of golden era, those first few years. There was a men's team. We were all living together, all working together. It was just one kind of... I think it was one guy. There was one guy who had a family, so he didn't live with us. But otherwise, the whole team all lived together. It was great. You know, really intensive. A few kind of battles here and there, but great. I really
a good training
made
ground.
A man of me. Yeah, made a Buddhist of me.
Made a Buddhist of you.
Yeah.
It's weird because it does remind me in terms of the story about boarding school and JP Morgan. Is like the intensity, particularly of a male environment like that.
That's where you're true, just obviously a big difference here being that actually there were people who kind of, I don't know, they had social skills, they had a heart, they had communication
they cared about
skills,
you.
They cared about me. Yeah, that's right, they cared about you. You're actually right, that's the main difference. They cared about me and I was very lucky that Jairaja was there because I could be pretty aggressive, but he could meet that. A lot of Buddhists are often, more sensitive types and would quail away a bit, but he could meet that. So I would always be very grateful to him for that. He wouldn't just melt away if I was in it.
So there's your training. There's your training at Karanar. So when do you enter the order?
Well, that's 2005, so 6 years later. Yeah.
Now I wondered. I mean, we'll fast forward to the present day in a bit, just to talk about what you do now, what you're about to start doing. I wondered, so when the crash happened, what was your kind of take on that at the time? I mean, how did you feel about it, knowing that world and knowing...
Funny, as soon as when the crash happened, immediately what I thought about was 9/11, actually.
Oh, right, was that a big thing for you?
Yeah, it was, in a way, because I did spend 5 months working on Wall Street, and I knew exactly that area very well, where the Twin Towers were. And, I wasn't aware of anyone I knew... dying in that, but it was only it was only 2 years after I left the city. My major thought was people I know or world I know has been attacked and a lot of media. So I remember that was the crash that I first since you said that, the crash, which I guess you mean the credit crash of 2008, the effect on me of that, I mean by then to be honest I felt a long way away from the city. I I don't really pay much attention to the markets, and I was never that interested, to be honest. I was interested in being rich, but I was never that interested in the financial markets. Yeah. Can't imagine that many people are. But anyway, some are. I mean, I was certainly very glad that I was out of it.
Right.
I mean, worst case scenario, you know, because I was right at the heart of the very product that caused the mess. I mean, maybe I would have, I don't know if this is still the case, but they were talking about criminal charges being applied to some of those people as well as just fines to the banks.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I doubt I would have, that would happen, but you never know. What certainly would have been the case is that I would have, I'd be very rich, but I'd have to tell people how I made that money, and of course that would be rather embarrassing. You know.
Well, we were talking about this today, weren't we, about this, when you gave a talk about this relatively recently, and you told people the information I was an investment banker, and they booed.
That's right.
I thought it was amazing.
Well, sure, and it's really true, it's widespread. I went to a recent reunion of my old Cambridge Rowing Club, and there were a couple of people there who were still in investment banking, and we were talking about recruitment for investment banking. Now, when I was getting into investment banking, everybody wanted to do, I mean, all the, you know, all the people at Cambridge, or at least the ones of a certain type, I guess, but anyway, the really ambitious ones, they wanted to be investment bankers or management consultants, and that meant Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, McKinsey, you know, the very top names like that. He said they find it so hard to recruit people. No, you know, the top people don't want to go to investment banking anymore. They want to go into tech, to go work for Google or Facebook or something. So part of the attraction is something a bit more exciting, but also it's just embarrassing to say to people, I'm an investment banker. I mean, it's just got a bad rep, hasn't it? Rightly so, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess I was kind of glad to be out of it, but I felt a long way out of it, to be honest.
Sure. And Sangha, you mentioned Sangha earlier. There was an experience of Sangha that was important in their Buddhist community.
Well, very early on, yes, in as much as Maitreya Bandhu, who ordained me and has been a good friend, when I was very new, he put together a group of guys into a study group, and one of the guys now on day called Satchidasa, he said, well, hey, why don't we start an outreach group in Brixton, South London? And so we start an outreach group, and so suddenly I was meeting the study group Monday night, and then Tuesday night we were going and doing the outreach group. So 2 days in a row I was doing the Buddhist stuff, and suddenly I got, well, two things. I got momentum in my practice because I was meditating 2 days in a row, and also I think there's something in terms of merit, actually, you know, going out and starting a Buddhist group, there's a lot of merit in that, and I think that benefited me. And also we were doing something together, you know, we were actually putting something on together. So I mean, from that study group, there's several who are now in the order who, you know, and we were working together as well as studying together. So that was the beginnings of Sangha. I mean, obviously the Karanar years were Sangha squared.
Sangha cube
probably. And that has been very important to me because, you know, I was a pretty, in a way, not rough character perhaps, but like very aggressive, very one pointed. You know, there's a lot. I needed a lot of training. You know, a lot of training.
Taming,
in a way. You know, yeah, there was energy there and drive and all the rest of it. Yeah, but there was a lot of this aggression and anger and a bit intensity, you know, kind of a narrowness. And all that needed more than just a weekly class. It needed friends around me reflecting that back and challenging that and showing me something else.
Yeah.
So I'm very glad that I had that really intensive Sangha experience of living and working together. And I did loads of Karanar appeals. I mean, I don't know how many. Count, but 15 or 20, I don't know. So I was doing 3 or 4 Karanar appeals a year for a few years, so that was very intensive practice.
Rubbed some sharp edges off.
It did, yeah. That's a good mess for you.
So here we are, 2014. Yeah. What is Amlavatra's Dharma life now?
Well, it's about to change a bit because I'm going to move here to Adistana. I mean, that's a big commitment in a way, you know, to leave London where I've been for almost 20 years. Come out here in the middle of nowhere, the countryside.
It is kind of in the middle. It's lovely. It's in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. But it is in the middle of nowhere.
And with a group of people I don't know that well. I mean, some I know a bit, you know. But you know, I'm leaving behind a really great community in London.
So why do you want to make the move?
Well, I think, you know, I'm now 41, and I'm thinking, I've decided not to have family. So what am I doing? Well, my work really is trying to, in my case, raise money for this movement, which I think is a great force for good in the world. It's the force for good that I know about, that I believe in. So I want to put my life energy in a way into making that prosper. And I can see how money is often a barrier to loads of great projects and those great people.
Yeah,
I think there's loads of money around. You just need to sort of ask for it, really, and find interesting ways of asking for it and earning it. So, you know, by this stage in life, I'm pretty clear what my life's about, and I just want to put myself into that.
And why does this place represent that particularly? Because in a way, the London Buddhist Centre is a huge centre of practice and focus for good in the world? Why is it?
Yeah, it's true. I could have fundraised for them, although I think they've already got that covered pretty sure. Well. But actually, I work for the development team, the European development team. At the moment, I'm working on my own in my bedroom, which I don't enjoy very much. I'm quite sociable. So coming here, I'll be able to work physically alongside people, share ideas, get sparked other people off, and really get some stuff going in terms of projects, in terms of fundraising. So I think I'll enjoy the work more. I think I'll be more effective. And I am interested to see the effect on my mind of living here in the countryside rather than London, which is buzzy, which I love, but also I think probably does limit sometimes the depth I can get to in meditation, just in my mind generally.
Yeah. Unfortunately, only 3 hours away on the train. So if you...
Yes, that's right. That's right.
If and when you miss it.
Yes.
You can always get back.
I'm anticipating that, yeah.
Ease yourself in.
That's right. That's
gently.
Right. Yeah.
Well, listen, that's great to hear your story. It's always fascinating hearing these different voices from all over the order. You can tune into them at thebuddhacentre.com. You can also find us on SoundCloud. I want to thank Amala Vajra for his story today. Still mysterious at the end of it. In a certain, the magic of the Dharma changing somebody in quite interesting conditions.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's brought you to this point.
Yeah.
May you be well as you go on.
Thank you very much.